From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. How will Maryland's Democratic legislature work with Republican Governor-elect Larry Hogan? We talk with Speaker Michael Bush, the top Democrat in the House of Delegates, and Republican Kathy Schlega, the House Minority Whip. Then, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns has done deep dives into topics that define America: jazz, baseball, the Civil War. He tells us he begins the research for each film with a simple guiding question.
One you'll know that will never be answered fully, which is, who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans?
Plus, our movie mavens Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post, and Jed Dietz, head of the Maryland Film Festival, bring us their indie film picks. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Hours after the votes were counted this week, Republican Governor-elect Larry Hogan Jr. promised a bipartisan approach.
We're going to be reaching out to try to find the most capable and most qualified people we can in state government, to put into state government, and we're going to do that in a bipartisan fashion. This is really about the people of Maryland. As I said last night, it doesn't matter to me whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you voted for us or not. We're all going to work together, roll up our sleeves, and work in a bipartisan fashion, reaching across the aisle, and trying to come up with bipartisan common sense solutions.
Sounds great, but the General Assembly is still controlled by Democrats. Smaller majorities than they had, but still big majorities in both houses. How is their agenda going to mesh, or not, with Governor Hogan's? To start understanding the new dynamic in Annapolis, we've invited two leaders in the House of Delegates. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Republican Whip Kathy Schlega. First, House Speaker Mike Bush joins us from Annapolis. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Hi. Morning, Sheila.
Good
morning.
Glad
to be with you.
Now, Speaker Bush, if there is a single issue that propelled Larry Hogan into office, it was his promise to try to roll back recent tax increases, although he has not been specific about which taxes or how much. Are the Democrats interested in talking about tax reduction, and if so, what?
Look, I think that, the first thing you have to look at is balancing the budget. I mean, we just came out of a recessionary period. I mean, there's two state mandates that you have to follow according to the Constitution. One is that you have to balance the budget every 90 days, unlike the federal government, and you have to fund an adequate and equitable education for every child in the state. There are two mandates that you have to follow. No one actually went to Annapolis saying, gee, we need to raise more revenues. In fact, the revenues didn't come in, but to meet those mandates, you had to come up with what you thought was a fair and balanced approach to revenues. If Governor Hogan can balance the budget and fund the education to the levels that needs to be funded to meet the constitutional mandate and the requirements by the courts, and there's money left over, you can certainly take a look at reducing taxes. I mean, I think that people are open to taking a look at the revenue structure of the state of Maryland. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think any governor that comes in wants to look at the revenue structure, see if it's fair and equitable to everyone. That's a fair assessment. I don't think a lot of the rhetoric that took place in the campaign about $2 billion worth of waste, fraud, and abuse is somehow in state government. I mean, that's just not there. Over the last 8 years, everybody's looked for efficiencies in government before they raise revenues. Everyone has worked to restructure the pension system to meet the new Wall Street guidelines. So there was a lot of cuts and reduction in the state government over the last 8 years, as well as revenue. So I think you have to come in and take a hard look at the government. It's a lot tougher governing than it is running for office. But I think that Governor Hogan wishes the same things that all of us want, and that's for everybody to work together in the best interest of citizens of Maryland. That's the ultimate goal. We're committed to that in the Maryland House of Delegates. I think that'll happen in a bipartisan way, hopefully. But obviously it is split government, and I think it's upon all of us in the best interest of citizens to work together.
So you say you do not think that Governor-elect Hogan will find the waste that he campaigned often, saying there's a lot of waste in state government. You don't think he'll find it. If he should send you a budget where he's made cuts, the legislature can only cut further, correct?
Right. Look, I mean, the governor of the state of Maryland puts in the budget. Governor Hogan put in the budget or reflect his priorities. But like I say, he has to meet a couple mandates. One is the budget has to be balanced, and the other is it's got to fund K through 12 education. As you know, we've gone through about 8 years of fully funding what was known as Thornton since 2003. The amount of money the state puts into public education has gone from $2.9 billion to $6.2 billion this year. The rate of growth in our public education system is really eating up most of the revenues that have come into the budget, but he has to meet both of those standards. And then the question is, what does he do about his transportation issues? I mean, we have passed gas tax. I mean, there's a trigger for that to continue to go up. Does he want to delay that? Does he want to shift any of the highway user money into the general fund budget, or does he want to pay it out straight to the subdivisions? So, I mean, there's a lot of questions, but I do think you need to sit down and have those discussions. We have a very experienced leadership team in both the House and the Senate. They understand the governance of the state of Maryland. I would hope that the new governor, Mr. Hogan, would sit down with the leadership teams and have a full and fair and frank discussion on what challenges that face the state of Maryland and different options to solve those problems. But, you know, it's going to take a lot of communication. It takes a lot of hard work. And, you have two houses of the General Assembly, both independent bodies, both with their own mindsets and philosophies as well, even if they're both controlled by Democrats. But we'll go forward, and hopefully at the end of the day that beneficiaries of our work are the citizens that we represent.
Speaker Bush, thank you for talking to us.
Sheila, thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks. Speaker Mike Bush, who represents the Annapolis area of Anne Arundel County. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. And joining us now from Perry Hall in Baltimore County is Delegate Kathy Shalega. She's the number 2 Republican in the House, the minority whip. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on your reelection to your second term. What did you hear from Speaker Bush that you'd like to respond to?
Well, I was very pleased to hear that, you know, we are going to be working together. I want to assure the citizens of Maryland that we do work well together. And we certainly evidenced by last session, we recoupled the inheritance tax and brought tax relief to the citizens of Maryland in a bipartisan fashion. So a lot of what we do is bipartisan, and we work together on those things. There are of course, some of the issues that do become partisan, but we have a great relationship with the Speaker. I think very, very highly of him. And Delegate Nick Kipke, the leader in the GOP caucus in the House, and I are very anxious to sit down and work with him, and we all have the best interest of the citizens at heart.
Many pundits have written that the legislature is likely to be more polarized because many of the Democrats who lost seats were from districts that elected more moderate Democrats in the past. What kind of confrontation are you expecting?
Well, I think divided government always has confrontation. It's just the nature of what the founding fathers had envisioned for accountability purposes. So not all confrontation is bad when it comes to legislatures. It's representing the ideas of the citizens who elected you and sent you to Annapolis to present bills and do the work that they and the ideas that they believe in. So I would say on both fronts, unfortunately, the redistricting every 10 years always brings about new membership, and some of what was done in the redistricting was partisan redistricting. And I do think that we're going to get legislators on both sides. Certainly, many of those on the Democrat side are going to be, and those that were elected are much more liberal than the people that they replaced, whether they had retired or whatever. And on the other side, on the Republican side, I do think that there are going to be more conservatives. But we all want to work together. This is representing the people in the districts that sent us to Annapolis and working together to accomplish great things for our state.
Delegate Shalega, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delegate Kathy Shalega of Perry Hall, House Minority Whip. We've got more on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Just ahead, Ken Burns' Baltimore connection. Stay tuned for that.
Producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Ken Burns has had an enormous impact, not just on filmmaking, but on how we understand our history. He's given us a long, deep look at the Civil War and World War II, the American pastime baseball, the American musical form jazz, and the people who have shaped our history, like the Roosevelts. Along the way, he's been awarded 12 Emmys, 2 Oscar nominations, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and 25 honorary degrees. He's coming to town Tuesday for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. So this morning we get a chance to ask him how he does what he does. He joins us on the phone. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Sheila.
How do you choose the topics of your documentaries?
You know, the glib, simple answer is they choose me. I'm interested in a good story. It's funny, I've known since I was 12 I wanted to be a filmmaker, and by the time I was 18 I knew I wanted to make documentary films. I didn't know I wanted to make history films or American history films. That's just the way a painter might choose to work in oil as opposed to watercolor, or to choose still lifes instead of landscapes. It just happens to be, and I feel very fortunate, how I practice what I do. And what I do is get up every morning and try to tell a good story. And in my case, all of those stories happen to be in American history. So I think you're looking always, the antennas out, for something that resonates, both in the intimate, in the immediate, specific, but in the general, trying to form a question, at least one you'll know that will never be answered fully, which is, who are we? Who are those strange and complicated people who like to call themselves Americans? And I think if you looked at the wide range of choices I've made, from the Brooklyn Bridge to the Shakers to Civil War to baseball to jazz, they're all an attempt to sort of mine a subject that seems to reveal ourselves to us.
I get that is your overall focus, but I read in the interview that you did with Joe Berkowitz from Masterclass, he said, this was not out of your mouth, he said that you don't do a great deal of research before choosing a topic, and then you are researching constantly.
That's
while
right.
You are, I don't get how you can
create that
while it's moving under your feet.
I understand how it can be confusing. Here's, I don't want to do subjects that I know about and then tell you or your audience what they should know. The last time I checked, that's called homework. You know, no one wants that. What I'd rather do is have the finished film represent a process of discovery. So I may not do a lot of research before I say yes to a topic, the way you the way you fall in love with someone. You don't do a lot of research. You just fall in love. It's a chemistry. It happens. And so I fall in love with the subject. I say yes. And then it is nonstop research rather than a specific delineated period in a production schedule in which you research for 3 weeks or 3 months, followed by writing for 3 weeks or 3 months, which produces a script which is written in stone like it's brought down by Moses from Mount Sinai, and that's what informs the shooting and the editing. We never stop researching. We never stop writing, and so we remain corrigible and open to those enthusiasms, those kind of passions, that sharing a subject as we learn it with somebody else. And I think the success of the films is the proof of that pudding. That is to say that people aren't being lectured to. There's not a sense that it's homework, and yet a sense of discovery. Even within, for example, the Roosevelt family, I can't begin to tell you how many people said, I didn't know that, and I said I didn't know that 100 times an episode to my children or to my wife or to my husband, and that meant a lot to me.
That's filmmaker Ken Burns here on 88.1 Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Burns will be in town Tuesday for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. I understand one of your cinema photographers is a Baltimore guy, Alan
Indeed.
Moore.
Indeed. Well, you're talking to one as well, of sorts. I was not born in Baltimore, but my father grew up there, and my parents married there, and I had lived in Baltimore, and I still have relatives in the area. So, and I'm a cinematographer, but the one you're speaking about is an extraordinarily gifted cinematographer, director of photography named Alan Moore that I've worked with since the late 80s. So it's, many, many decades of fine cinematography. If you can close your eyes and think of beautiful gravestones in the Civil War series or in other films, that's Alan's superb work. And we've counted on him for every project since the Civil War to be part of the palette of our filmmaking.
Because I am not a cinematographer, I did not know until I did a little research for this conversation that there is something called the Ken Burns effect, which is like
part of filmmaking. Well, less part of filmmaking than it is part of Apple. Steve Jobs called me in 2002, in December of 2002, and said, we've been trying to perfect, and now we think we have perfected this thing we're calling the Ken Burns effect. And next month, in January of 2003, all Mac computers will have this program on. And what it was a simple pan and zoom of photographs that had been uploaded, downloaded into people's collections in iPhoto or iMovie. And they added music. And I can tell you that in an indirect way, I've saved thousands of birthdays, vacations, bar mitzvahs, that sort of thing. But what it refers to is, and I'm not paid for that, you should know. In fact, our agreement is that I gave equipment to nonprofits. So what it really refers to is a much more complicated dynamic that I've been employing since my very first film, of how to wake up a still photograph, to film it with the energy that a feature filmmaker would, presented with a master shot. That is to say that it would have its own long shot, medium, close, tilt, pan, reveal, inserts of different shots. And I do that with the still photographs. And I don't only just look at them, but I listen to them and try to wake them up with not just third-person narration, but first-person voices, sound effects, period music, that sort of thing, the commentary of people who were there or knew what had happened when those things took place. It's basically trusting that an old photograph, an arrested, frozen moment from the past, had itself a past and a future, and it's how you wake the dead, how you animate it, that is, now called the Ken Burns effect. For me, it's just a tool of my trade, and what Steve Jobs immortalized is a little bit different and off to the side than what I try to practice and improve on every day.
What documentaries are you working on now?
Well, I'm deep into one on the history of the war in Vietnam. It's 10 parts. It's nearly 20 hours. It's consuming me. That's not the first thing you'll see. The first thing you'll see, I've served as the executive producer and senior creative consultant and a co-writer on a film called Cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies, a three-part, six-hour film that's being produced and directed by a great filmmaker named Barrett Goodman, who I've been working with. That'll be out next spring. I'm working with my daughter Sarah Burns and her husband, the filmmaker David McMahon. We produced a couple of years ago The Central Park Five. We're now producing a two-part
documentary. We spoke with Sarah then.
Yeah, on Jackie Robinson, sort of continuing a long-standing theme that runs through my films, but only because it runs through American history, about race, and then Vietnam, and then after that, we're delightfully shooting a massive history called I Can't Stop Loving You, about the history of country music. And I've also begun work on a two-part, four-hour biography of the literary titan, Ernest Hemingway.
What a list. I read an interview with you where you hinted that since you like history to be at least 30 years in the rearview mirror, that it may be time to be thinking of a documentary about the Clinton presidency.
Well, you know, the American Experience program on PBS did a really credible job. In fact, it was produced, coincidentally, by Barack Goodman. And so I sort of feel like that territory has been cleared out. But you're right. There is, within that kind of 10 or 15, 25 years, whatever it is, and that, you know, there's no law, things feel journalistic, as if we haven't had the time to triangulate, as if we haven't had the time to gain the wisdom that the passage of time and perspective provides us. And that's why I'm loath, even in the films of mine that come up to the present, like baseball, to make hard and fast judgments, or jazz, or other films, because you just don't know what hindsight will finally decide about a particular thing. You know, Philip Graham, who used to run the Washington Post, had that very famous statement that journalism is the first rough draft of history. And it's a wonderful phrase, but you then have to remember that none of us turn in a rough draft. And so what history is trying to sort of refine and go back and get right what we think happened from the journalistic report. And I can tell you right now, our film series on Vietnam will upend almost 100% what you think happened. Just the day-to-day received conventional wisdom is so superficial and now so apparently wrong and upside down that I think every episode will not only be, we hope, good filmmaking, but a revelation, not just to an ordinary audience sort of imprisoned by that conventional wisdom and the superficiality that that implies, but even by a scholarship and people who've spent their lives delving into this subject. And a lot of it has to do with the particular access we've had to Vietnam and dissidents there and records there that I think will make this very exciting for people, as well as, of course, an incredible tragedy over five presidencies and 30 years.
It does sound exciting. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ken Burns. He'll be in town Tuesday for the Baltimore Speaker Series, presented by Stevenson University. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
And good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us on this sunny Friday post-election morning for the Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. As always, Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival joins us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, is here as well, and we are awfully glad about that. Good to see you, Ann.
Thank you.
So, Jed, let's start with a couple of things before we talk about some movies. The Maryland Film Festival is collaborating with Maryland Institute College of Art and Hopkins to renovate the historic Parkway Theater in Station North, on North Avenue. You're going to have a center for film and production and film study, that kind of thing. And you've received a big, big grant to help get that project off the ground.
Yeah, it's an amazing grant that really Ron Daniels at Hopkins went after. And it's from an international, a great international foundation called the Stavros Niarchos Foundation. They've done a bunch of big projects in Greece and Europe. They've done some cultural stuff in New York City. This is the first cultural gift in Baltimore, and it's it means we're going to be able to open this building with these three screens and bring in more movies to Baltimore for audiences that follow us by 2016. So by the fall of 2016. So it's
good. So give us a quick thumbnail sketch of what's going to be in this building. You got three screens, 600 some seats or something.
Yeah. So the biggest screen is the old Parkway Theater, which was one of the important movie palaces in America. It opened in 1915. So, 12 years before they were talking movies even. And it was a movie palace all the way through 1978 when it closed. And then there will be two smaller screens, roughly 100 seat capacity. So we'll have 600 seats total in the building. Just to give you some comparison, that's about half the size of the Charles. Mm-hmm. And it's across the street from 10 East North, which is being developed by Jubilee, and the fast expanding film programs from both MICA and Hopkins will go in that building. So the production and classroom work and all that stuff will be at 10 East North in the old center building, and we will be exhibition space for them. So there will be a flow back and forth along that block of North Avenue that hasn't existed before and will fit in beautifully to this great arts district that artists started building before it was called an arts district.
Yeah, and Baltimore is going to become a better and better place to study film, to think about film, and to work in film. That's
great. Absolutely.
And Anne Hornaday, speaking of studying film and working in film, one of the great lights of the film community in Baltimore passed away recently, Michael Schamburg.
Indeed.
Tell us about him.
Yeah, Michael Schamburg was a wonderful filmmaker who was from Baltimore, sort of made his bones in New York in the early 80s when he had studied art at the Art Institute in Philadelphia, moved to New York, and became involved with the band New Order from Manchester, England, and became very important in their enterprise in terms of producing their music videos. He introduced them to filmmakers like Jonathan Demme and Catherine Bigelow, who made videos for the band. I met Michael in the late 1990s. He had moved back to Baltimore to help his elderly parents, and he had also made a film called Souvenir. He had made it in Paris with the likes of Kristin Scott Thomas and Christina Ricci and Stanton Miranda, his leading lady. It played here at the Charles, and I got to know Michael around that and got to know him, both him and Miranda. And he's just a wonderful guy, a great putterer togetherer of artists of all stripes, not just filmmakers. And he was just one of those catalyst-like figures who will be really, really missed.
Yeah. That's great. And you knew him pretty well as well, Jack.
Yeah, he'd been on our screening committee. He had helped us get to various films and always had a great view of the film internationally, the film world. And most amazingly, after he got sick, and he was tragically sick for quite a while and really fought hard. I mean, incredible struggle. And he would come to movies. He hosted some movies when he was pretty physically compromised. He was a real spirit.
Indefatigable. I mean, I think one of the last times I saw him was at the National Gallery of Art, where his Souvenir screened, and along with another French film a couple of years ago. And he was just an inspiration to everyone he encountered.
All right, well, let's talk about a few movies that are in the current rotation at various places. Citizen Four is now out. This is the Laura Poitras movie about Edward Snowden. You've seen it. Both you guys have seen it. Jed, what do you think?
It's an extraordinary movie. I don't think I've ever seen a documentary that is literally chronicling a story as it's unfolding. So you're sort of right there as people are thinking out what their next move is and what to do. And Laura Poitras, this filmmaker, we've had two of her films at the festival, My Country, My Country, which was nominated for Academy Award, and The Oath. And she has this amazing ability to get people to trust her, which is one of these essential ingredients for a great documentary filmmaker, and reveal things that they want to reveal.
And we should remind folks that Edward Snowden was in touch. Ms. Poitras was part of this story.
She was the first person he contacted.
Right.
He tried to get to Glenn first because he wanted a journalist to help him think out how to do this, how to disclose what he wanted to disclose. Unlike Julian Assange or the Bradley Manning dump of stuff in the WikiLeaks case, Edward Snowden wanted to be very careful about what he revealed. He had a mission to let people know there was much more surveillance going on after 9/11 than anybody had any idea or anybody in the government was admitting. And he just wanted, as a democracy, people to think about it because there's no protection built in. You know, there's no courts, there's nothing. It's just being surveyed. We're being surveyed. And but he wanted to do it carefully. He's 29 years old when you see him in this movie, and he didn't know how to do it. He knew what kind of information he had, and so he wanted journalists to help him. And Glenn said he just couldn't communicate with him because it had to be encrypted and all this stuff. So that stopped, and there's really no communication. And he found Laura through her films, and she thought he was some CIA guy trying to get into her computer because she'd been harassed as she was making her films, her first two films. And in this part of the trilogy, she and Glenn go to Hong Kong. They don't know this guy's name. They don't really know who he is. And you see all this on camera. You see them meet each other. You see them think out what he wants to do. And however you feel about Snowden and what he's done, I think you can't come out of this film unimpressed by the effort, at least, he's trying to make. And mm-hmm. and the film as entertainment is stunning.
Yeah, I mean, and as a movie,
exactly.
I mean, this is quite a movie.
It's a real-time spy thriller. I mean, it has all the trappings of John Le Carré, including when they meet, you know, the little tells that he tells, you know, like, you'll know me by the boutonniere in my collar kind of a thing.
The Rubik's Cube.
But really, it's just the way that she sort of keeps it in this hotel room, this claustrophobic hotel room where they're all trapped for 8 days together while he tells his story to a Guardian reporter, and they're all feeling each other out. And it, as Jed said, regardless of how you feel about him, it's just essential viewing in terms of the issues that it raises and the insights that it provides about his motivations and his behavior.
All right, Citizen 4. Do we know where it is?
It's at the Charles.
At the Charles Theater. Okay, here in Baltimore. That's great. There's another one called Laggies. This is one of these that's described by the filmmakers as a quarter-life crisis. but we've got Lynn Shelton as the director, Keira Knightley, Chloe Grace Moretz, and Sam Rockwell. Starting this movie is a little fun.
This is a 28-year-old played by Keira Knightley, who is at the opposite end of the spectrum from Edward Snowden. She has no clue who she is or what she's doing. She said she would get married and then sort of understands she's really a teenager. She doesn't know anything. And it's this, Lynn Shelton's this wonderful filmmaker, and she did not write this. She often works in very improvisatory style. She did Your Sister's Sister, and Hump Day. And she's been at the festival a bunch of times, and it's a totally charming. I think it's one of the great pieces of work that Keira Knightley's done. Very light, very small, but fun to see.
And I want to put a plug in for Sam Rockwell.
Oh,
I mean,
indeed.
I thought he was just a revelation. And I mean, he's always been a fascinating actor to watch. I'm not sure I would ever have called him a romantic leading man until this movie,
uh-huh.
because he
go.
Is H.O.T. hot,
nice.
Ladies and gentlemen. So
right.
just take that under advisement.
Good to hear. there's a movie called The Theory of Everything. I guess, Jed, you had some screenings of this that were sort of oversold, but James Marsh is the director of this. He's very well known for that terrific documentary, Man on Wire. And Theory of Everything is about Stephen Hawking, the great physicist, and the relationship between Mr. Hawking and his wife.
Yeah. And this opens in a couple weeks at the Charles. It's a story about romance. I mean, one of the parties in the romance is this incredible thinker and cosmologist, Stephen Hawking, who we've known. But it's so much focused on them falling in love and then him being diagnosed with ALS, and which is fatal, and you know, and they think will kill him in 2 years, which is the normal path, and you know, it's about the struggle of people who care very deeply about each other, also with careers, but really trying to figure this relationship out. And it's a pretty remarkable movie made by a documentary filmmaker working in fiction for the first time. I mean, the story is based on truth, but it's all scripted and actors and mm-hmm. stuff. And the actors are extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, this is already obviously getting Oscar buzz for Eddie Redmayne's performance, because as a physical performance, it's absolutely astonishing. But Felicity Jones, who plays his wife, Jane, I think, you know, the way the story is structured in terms of her point of view and her own selfhood coming, you know, she's not the traditional helpmeet, you know, and self-sacrificing good wife to this genius. I mean, it has that kind of trapping of the great man theory of cinema, but it subverts it. And I think the filmmaking, just the pure cinema, the visual expression of it is absolutely gorgeous, especially in that final 20 minutes. I think Marsh just does something so meaningful and poetic that really lifts it from the conventional biopic.
And of course, Mr. Hawking is just such an interesting figure anyway. Mm-hmm. He's the guy you sort of want to know about, you know, so I can imagine it's really fun to sort of get inside
it
and see
is.
What his life is like.
Yeah, it really is.
There's another movie out that I know, like so many things, absolutely nothing about, called Whiplash. What's that about?
Well, this is.
I take it this was neither of your favorites.
No, this, and we're in the very tiny minority because this has gotten huge critical response starting at Sundance. It was a huge hit at Sundance. I think it's.
Tell us what it's about.
It's about a young jazz drummer, aspiring jazz drummer, who's at the great music school, and he gets into the great jazz band in the school. That is conducted and run by J.K. Simmons is the actor who plays a character named Terrence Fletcher, who's this great jazz man. And he's the drill sergeant from Full Metal Jacket. That's the character. He's a beast. You know, he's a total monster. There have been horrible consequences coming from his methodology of teaching. And I think what it says about music is not much.
But Anne, you take this off your list as well.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the performances were impressive. Yeah. And the music, when you can hear it over his yelling and abusive, sadistic language, it's gorgeous. But yeah, I had deep reservations.
Music
about
and sadism, I know a little bit about that.
That's
a conductor.
Your biopic.
All right, we'll see if you like it, Tom.
Well, Jed Dietz, Anne Hornaday, always a pleasure. We shall see you next month.
Thank you.
That's it for us this morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Coffee is provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. They're on the web at zekescoffee.com. We're online at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Payam Agagasam, Elizabeth Sherwood, and Connor Graham. And today, we say goodbye to a cherished member of the Maryland Morning team.
Today is the last day here at Maryland Morning for an amazing producer, Jamila Kay. She's been with us more than 2 years now. She came on board to help produce our series on race and inequality in the Baltimore region, The Lines Between Us.
Jamila helped us explain the human consequences of inequality in the Baltimore area. She found a man who works with at-risk youth whose own son was in the Baltimore County Detention Center for attempted murder.
Blows my mind. It brings me to tears every time I think about it. But it speaks to the fact that Solly Soul. He lived in a community that was filled with drugs and crime, and I wasn't there.
The Lines Between Us won an Alfred I. DuPont Columbia Award, one of the most prestigious in broadcasting, and we are proud of Jamila for being such a big part of that series.
In the year since that series ended, Jamila has continued to tell insightful and compelling stories. She profiled a number of senior citizens for an occasional series called Senior Portraits, including Chuck from Bowie.
Automobile mechanic by trade, motorcycle rider by night.
Chuck has ridden motorcycles since he was 16. He used to ride around Maryland with a group called the Backyard Motorcycle Club.
From the old town of Bowie, we used to have a spot they called the Back Road, where everybody used to hang. About 12 of us. Used to go out riding, go to Annapolis a lot, Severna Park, the district every now and then.
Jamila Kay tells stories with grace, compassion, and aplomb. It's been a joy to have her as part of the Maryland Morning team. We'll miss her, and we wish her all the best as she begins a new endeavor, working with underserved kids to help them navigate the process of getting into and graduating from college.
Jamila will be doing that important work with a nonprofit based here in Baltimore called The Intersection. They're lucky to get her. You know, sometimes people who are good-looking and talented think they don't have to work hard. That is so not Jamila. Whatever work she does, we know she'll throw herself into it with full heart and head, and we wish her all the satisfaction and success that should follow. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. Back with you Monday.